Hi, this is Nate Checkitz, CEO and co-founder of Roan, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. Before we jump into this week's episode, I have to ask, has the coronavirus impacted your business? Sequoia Capital, a Silicon Valley venture capital firm, arguably the most successful VC firm in history, issued a letter warning about the impact of the coronavirus will have on our economy. They warned their portfolio companies to minimize expenses and shore up cash reserves. So again, I ask, has the coronavirus impacted your business? It definitely has impacted the Startup Story business. And no, not the podcast per se. The show is virus-free, so you can continue to listen with no fear of exposure. The coronavirus has impacted our live event plans, though. So make sure to visit our Facebook page for an update. I won't go into it in this episode, but visit facebook.com/thestartupstory. The event is definitely still scheduled, but there have been some significant changes. So make sure to visit facebook.com/thestartupstory. And before I forget, I want to thank the team at Fuse Workspaces for allowing me to use their podcast studio to record this episode. Check out workatfuse.com to learn more about their various locations. They have one that is north of Dallas and soon to be in Houston and Austin. All right, now let's jump into this week's episode. Our guest this week is Nate Checkitz, founder of Roan. Roan is an activewear brand specifically for men. So you know how you immediately associate Lululemon as a woman's brand? Well, that is what Roan is for men. In fact, that is really how it all started for Nate, when he was given a gift and a coworker immediately gave him a hard time because the brand is heavily branded among female consumers. Man, apparel is an incredibly hard industry. And what makes Nate's story so fascinating is that he is not a fashion-forward person, nor does he have a long career in the apparel logistics or any type of logistics business at all. He is simply an entrepreneur that was miserable in his career with the NFL that decided it was time to create a brand that matters. Oh wait, did my mention of the NFL spark your interest? I mean, who wouldn't be miserable working for the NFL, right? Okay, enough with the episode teasing. Just like every episode, we need to start at the beginning of it all to fully understand how someone might actually find themselves unhappy working for an icon of a brand like the NFL.
I grew up in a big family, six kids. I'm a middle child. You know, like most middle children in large families, I had a lot of time by myself where I was like just coming up with harebrained contraptions, ideas. I wanted to be an inventor when I was younger because my poor mom was trying to keep up with six kids' schedules and, you know, making dinner. And she basically spent all of her time in the car. That gave me a lot of time, just me and my younger brothers, who I was particularly close to. I've got two younger brothers that were all 2 years apart. And we were always hatching harebrained ideas, contraptions. And, you know, that was everything from lemonade stands to usually we were trying to sell something, trying to find a way to make money. We didn't call it entrepreneurship, but we wanted to be able to buy stuff, and that required making money.
What did your dad do? Like, where did that idea come from, right? Because, I mean, it's not, a lot of people have a bubblegum hustle, but we can always point to some person in our life that gave us that inspiration to start some. Who was it for you?
Yeah, my dad is an amazing and accomplished business executive. And to call a spade, I was super fortunate to grow up with him for a father. And my mom, I have very incredible parents. But my father was really came from nowhere in the sense that his father wasn't particularly, you know, well-known or successful. His father was a mobile home sales person. So my dad grew up on a lot selling mobile homes. And he used to tell us that the reason he was so strong is he would take these concrete blocks and he would do arm curls with them, which I'm now, being a father, I'm wondering whether or not there's any truth to that whatsoever. But he graduated from college and got a really great job working at Bain Consulting because he was a great student. And while he was there, he had the opportunity to interview David Stern, who was the deputy commissioner of the NBA.
Oh, wow.
And the reason this came about is because the firm that he was at, Bain, Bill Bain, was looking to buy the Boston Celtics. And this basically led him on a path where David Stern was impressed by him knew that he had grown up in the state of Utah, and Utah had an NBA franchise recently acquired, same NBA franchise that's still there, the Utah Jazz.
Yep.
Called the owner of the Utah Jazz and said, hey, I've got this impressive 28-year-old who loves basketball, knows business. You should consider hiring him. And he got brought on at the tender young age of 28 years old to be the general manager of the NBA Utah Jazz, of that franchise.
That's awesome.
And that launched a long career in sports. So he was doing entrepreneurial things, but we didn't view it that way. You know, we viewed him as working in the sports industry.
That's incredible. And it's funny, just even hearing now your upbringing in the sports industry, knowing where this story ends up going with Roan, it's like, wow, you just immediately just start seeing and start connecting the dots and the breadcrumbs of life. That's awesome.
Totally. I think what's interesting is, as I started getting into high school, I remember thinking, this is an impossible legacy to live up to.
Yeah.
Youngest general manager in NBA history. There's no way I'm ever going to measure up to that. And by the way, that's true. I won't ever measure up to that. But I remember having this kind of moment of vulnerability with my dad and telling him, you know, how did you do it? How did you accomplish that? And I remember he said something to me that I was taken aback about. He said, you have to understand, when I took that job, that was a giant risk. That was like going to a tech startup in my day. That the Jazz were, at the time, $10 million in debt. They were considered to be misnamed. It was always a joke that you had the New Orleans Saints, which should have been in Utah, and the Utah Jazz, which should have been in New Orleans. My grandpa, my mom's father, was so worried about him taking this job that he got him an interview with a car dealership in Utah just as a fail-safe in case it didn't go through. Now, of course, over the next 2 years, they drafted John Stockton and Karl Malone, and things ended up working out quite well with the NBA media rights and everything else. But it's good to also contextualize the past. And that to me helped me realize, when I considered my career, I'm not going to go into this now established industry of sports and be able to make the same splash that my father did 30 years ago. I need to look at, what is the industry now where you can go in at a young age and still have a high level of impact and ability to make decisions? And coming out of school, that was clearly what was happening with technology and the internet more broadly, how it was changing commerce.
You know, it's interesting too, before we jump into the next steps in your journey, to hear your dad kind of unpack and add context to his story and the risk it was at the time. Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs, in fact, I was having this conversation just the other night over at dinner with a few other entrepreneurs, that a lot of times we don't live our entrepreneurial journey with our kids, that they don't get to see everything. And I think there's an advantage to sharing that. And you are, George, we're just speaking about it right now, that your dad was giving you context for the risks at play when he took that leap to be a part of the Jazz, and how you were able to see that and own that as your own as you were continuing on in your next step. So there's a value to sharing, as parents, our life, our journey with our kids.
Totally. And I think there's certainly a part of it where he was just seeing a son struggling with his identity and understanding, you know, his own inferiority complex, and was trying to make me feel better. What he accomplished at a young age was, nothing should be taken away from that. But it is helpful to contextualize it, and it is good to share those things with our kids. And it's something that I try to share with my kids as well.
That's awesome. So as you're trying to figure out what your next steps are, I'm assuming your upbringing is probably went to college, but what did you think you wanted to do as you were entering college?
Honestly, I had almost no clue what I wanted to do. I knew that going to college was the right next step. I also was out of the, there's four boys in my family. I think my three brothers all wanted to work in sports. I did not necessarily have a strong desire to work in the world of sports. I did have this chip on the shoulder, is not the right term, but I wanted to be able to go and kind of prove to myself more than anyone else that I could be successful in an industry. And given our unique last name, it would be impossible to do anything in the sports world, still is today, without people remembering my father's accomplishments. I'm incredibly proud to be a son, but I wanted to prove to myself that I could be successful. And so that was kind of almost the only parameter that I had. You know, I also grew up in the Northeast, which is, you're almost bred to believe that you're going to work in finance. You know, I thought maybe I'm going to go into investment banking. I thought maybe I would do management consulting, but I did know that it would likely be something associated with business.
Okay. So as you coming to the end of your university years, the natural, again, second chapter, you finish high school, first chapter, finish college, second chapter. What was your first step?
I actually didn't finish college before I took that first step. I did graduate from college, but when I was in between my junior and senior year, I did an internship with a company called Monitor Group, which is a management consulting firm that ended up selling to Deloitte. During that summer, while I was there as consultants, I was amazed with this idea that we could eat out pretty much every night as long as we stayed in the office past a certain point, and then we could bill that to the client. And most of the people in the company started using this new service called seamlessweb.com. You know, this is back in 2006. At the time, it just sounded, wait a minute, I can go on a website, order it, and then the food would be delivered straight to the office. It seemed so natural to me that that would be connected to the phone, but there was no application. The iPhone was launching that next year. And the way we think about smartphones today is just very, very different than the way we thought about smartphones back at that point. But text messaging was on the rise. And so I thought, well, you could still accomplish this. What if I could just text what I wanted? And I had this idea, okay, I'm going back to class. I'm sitting in my class. I knew that there was a girl in one of my classes who worked at the local cafe. And I just asked her, I said, hey, I did this thing over the summer. Can I just text you what I want and you have the order ready? So I don't have to, because I only have 15 minutes between my classes. So I want to be able to grab my stuff and eat. And then I just, you know, I pay. Like, it just seems so obvious to me. Naturally, that led to, wait a minute, there's a business here. So I wrote a business plan about connecting text messaging to restaurants for people to order on the in-between. And it sounds, again, obvious today, but at the time, there was nobody doing anything like that. The closest thing I could find was this seamless web experience. And so that's when I wrote my first business plan.
So what did you do with that business plan, though? Was it just really just a project to get it done, or did you actually try to make some traction on that?
There was a business plan competition. I noticed that there was 48 hours until submission. So I literally just wrote a business plan. I put in like friends' names on it you know, my own resume. I think I pulled an all-nighter to just complete it. We ended up making it to the state semifinals and getting some funding on it. So I deferred, much to my parents' dismay, I deferred this prestigious New York firm's offer coming out of college and decided to pursue this entrepreneurial journey. We ended up pivoting, somewhat strangely, into sports. So what we found is that the challenge of growing the restaurant and the consumer base was incredibly complex. You had to go convince restaurants that you were going to get consumers, and you had to go and convince consumers that you had enough restaurants that this was worthwhile to sign up and put credit card information. I still remember when we were trying to sell people on the idea that there was this board of successful business leaders that were all well over the age of 60. And one of the biggest criticisms from these guys were, this will never work, because if you put credit card information into your phone and you lose your phone, you know, you're at huge financial risk. And I remember thinking to myself, these guys have no clue what is about to come.
Yeah.
But long story short, that was kind of my first foray into entrepreneurship, was launching this company.
That's funny, because I had a mobile startup in the restaurant space as well. I mean, it was going to grow into other industries, but it started in restaurants. And you're right, that is a tough space to be in.
Oh, man. It really is
a chicken versus the egg kind of thing, trying to get the restaurants and consumers.
Yeah, you have a lot of individual operators. You have to do it based on a geography somewhat. So you can go and you can sign up a suite of restaurants. So let's say that Chipotle, which has all of these restaurants, but they're going to come to you and they're going to say, you have no presence in these 80 markets. Like, we'll do it in this one market. So the idea of shifting into sports stadiums made sense to me, because one, it was an environment I had grown up in and understood, and you could sign up one operator and get all of the windows inside a stadium or an arena, and then you could capture the audience in the stadium or the arena. The downside of that model is games aren't an ongoing thing. You're just not, people aren't showing up every day to go to a sports game. And so we ended up raising some outside capital, growing that business, and then basically selling the IP to the San Francisco 49ers as they were launching Levi Stadium. But trust me, there were a ton of failures in that process.
So what year, let's put some years on that. So what year did you start this venture? When did you raise capital and when did you sell?
So it was 2007 that we kind of officially launched. We ended up pivoting several times kind of in that initial 12 to 15 months into this sports stadium model. And really the IP sold in, call it 2010.
Okay. So in those years though, and again, that is, I mean, you were early stage in the apps as far as that, you know, because I mean, that
yeah, we iPhone were one was of the first iPhone yeah. applications,
yeah.
you know, when we actually built that. And it's tough because looking back, I think to myself, we were killing ourselves to build this one thing that people, you know, mobile payments is still such a nascent industry and it is so easy to use and people yeah. still yeah. struggle with it. But at the time we thought it was going to accelerate. If I had just taken our dev team and said, let's build a flashlight app, we would have probably made more money than we would have trying to build this incredibly complex yeah. backend with natural language processing. We could have built a compass app or a leveler at the time. We would have made more money.
I'll never forget the story early on. There's a teacher, a math teacher, who created a very simple game. I mean, I can't remember what the game was, but it was just stupid simple. It was 99 cents. And he was making $100,000 a month.
Yeah.
And just people buying the game. Like it was
yeah, totally.
it was the heyday back then. But, you know, here you are in this environment where things are new. You're trying to tackle something that is incredibly complex from an industry and business perspective, but also from a behavior perspective. It's not something that people are used to. You had funding, so there's a little bit of confidence that comes with that, but was there at any point in time that you're just like, you're just banging your head against the wall. Why am I doing this? Are we ever going to be able to pull this off? This is too early. What do we do now? I mean, what was that journey like for you?
Yeah, any point in time, it's like every single day I felt that way. That's the hard thing. That's the hard and good thing about being an entrepreneur is like you really are on this roller coaster. And I tell people it almost makes you unemployable afterwards because
100%.
One day you are like, we are taking over the world. We are going to be the future of mobile payments, first at sports stadiums, but then we're going to college campuses and hospitals and everything after that. We really genuinely believed we were going to take over the world at certain points. Mobile payments was such a massive industry and we were right at the forefront of that. Then there were days where it was like, are we going to be able to make payroll? And how on earth did I turn away this really good, stable income? I was married at the time. My wife and I were expecting and we started having kids quite young. So it was an absolute roller coaster of emotions to I'm a complete and total failure. Yeah. I can't believe I did this to my family to we're going to be the next Apple.
Just one quick reminder before we jump back into our episode. Startup Story Live is going to be an incredible entrepreneurial event in the Dallas marketplace. It is still happening. Coronavirus is not going to change that at all. There's just been a shift in dates and a shift in some talent that's going to be featured. So I hope you'll visit our update at facebook.com/thestartupstory to get all the details. That's it. I just want to give you an update on that. Now let's jump back into this week's episode. What was the journey that led you to the point of just, okay, I'm just going to sell the assets off. It's time to get out. It's time to exit and move on to something else. Did you already have your next venture in mind as to why you wanted to exit out, or what was that process?
No, it's a complicated story. I mean, and saying that we sold it, you know, makes it sound much more glamorous than it really was. The truth is that we really didn't have a choice. We weren't growing the way that we thought we would. We had some management issues. You know, when we raised our outside capital, we brought in an outside CEO. You know, I was young and I couldn't argue with that decision. The board ended up stepping in and letting that CEO go. And it led to a number of different factors. And I basically had control of the assets and was directed to sell them. It was a very difficult period for me because I just felt like I had put my heart and soul into this for 3 years and I had nothing to show for it. And created a lot of that self-doubt and anxiety of, I sit here and I look at somebody who built a flashlight app and yep. here we are, we had patents that we had granted to this super proprietary technology. you know, patents that are certainly now worth a lot of money that had our names on them, and we had very little to show for it. Yeah, it was a complicated, difficult process and difficult personal journey.
When that came to an end, and I want to talk about the learnings in that, but I want to talk about it leading up to actually the launching of Roan. But as that season was coming to an end, were you just done with entrepreneurship? You're like, I can't go through this again.
And, I was. I remember getting into my car, and you know, part of the last 2 months of the business, I had basically self-funded it with money that I really didn't have.
Yeah.
Any savings that I had had, and I put a little bit on credit cards. You know, one of the tough things about having a successful father is people make assumptions about what you may or may have not inherited. And I had never taken it outside of my parents paying for my college tuition, which I will forever be grateful for. I hadn't ever taken a dollar from them, you know, including our living expenses. Both my wife and I worked through college. And so she says to me, we're not going to be able to pay our credit card bill this next month unless we do something. And I remember looking at her, looking at my son, and thinking to myself, my goodness, I have completely failed. This is the pinnacle of failure. I got in my car and I got out on the freeway, and I was going well past the speed limit thinking, this is it.
Yep.
It was scary. It was a very, very scary time. And that's when I remember kind of looking at myself and thinking to myself, you're being so dramatic and you're being so selfish right now. Pick yourself up and get back on the horse and figure it out. And so I went back home and I got out my whiteboard and I figured out how I was going to pay for the next month's credit card bills, what I was going to do, and how I was going to figure out getting my career back on track. And that led me to basically starting a consulting practice that not only helped me pay off my credit card rather quickly, but put us into a good financial position to take the next step in my career.
That's incredible. As you get back on the horse, as you move forward, you make traction. What were those next steps in a quick briefing? What were those next steps that got you to the point where the thought and the inkling of what was to be Roan started coming into your vision?
So, you know, with this whiteboard, I realized I needed to fix the short-term gap of bringing in income. Mm-hmm. I went out to everyone I could think of. LinkedIn was growing, and I said, I've got general acumen and I'm happy to assist in any way, shape, or form. And as part of trying to sell the business, I had been working with this with Cisco Sports and Entertainment, a division of Cisco, the technology company, not the food company. And I said to them, you are trying to sell switches and routers into these sports stadiums and buildings. I was in 15 sports stadiums and I can help you get access there. And that was my first consulting contract. And I remember feeling guilty about what I was advised I could charge.
Yeah.
They didn't even blink.
Yep.
They didn't even bat their eye. That was a big experience for me. So I ended up bringing on another two clients.
Let me ask a quick question on that. You said you felt guilty. Again, you having to provide for your family, you just had a whiteboard session. Why did you feel guilty about that?
I had a lot of self-doubt about what value I was providing. I didn't know whether or not I was actually worthwhile, you know, enough to be able to charge, you know, the kind of hourly rate. And now looking back at it, I was like, I probably could have charged more.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was a difficult period.
Yeah. So you're consulting with Cisco and the journey continues on. Again, you're in the sports and I can start seeing the connecting of dots, but in my mind, you're still technology, but that's not where Roan is. So how do you get from there to Roan?
The long story is that I'm with Cisco. And as part of that, I end up meeting up with an executive at the NFL. I'm still trying to take this hub and spoke model of, can I go to leagues and get them to buy into the vision of what Cisco high density wireless is trying to put into sports stadiums and now get it into every single stadium in the country. Now, this particular sports executive I had met when I was younger because, much to my parents' dismay, I decided to start a sports camp in their backyard for kids without telling them. And this gentleman, who at the time did not work at the NFL but worked at NBC, sent his two kids. And I remember he was just one of the coolest parents. So when I met up with him at this meeting, I was like, how's Drew? How's Will? I remember your kids coming to my sports camp and he was like, I can't believe you. He's like, that's I'm hilarious. Not surprised you're an entrepreneur based on the fact that you are charging me too much money to watch my kids for a few hours every day. But he took me out to dinner and said, I really think you should consider coming to work at the NFL. I could use somebody with your background. Technology has changed so much over the last few years, and we really need to get smarter on it as a league. And by the way, I told him, I said, I appreciate that. That's very kind of you. But I was making so much more money consulting now with these three clients than I had been as a startup founder. And I was working probably 30 to 50% less. Mm-hmm. But I thought I had like cracked the code. So I was like, I appreciate that. It's probably not a good fit for me. I'm not super interested. I ended up talking to my dad about a week later. He's like, so, you know, what's the latest? I was like, oh, well, you know, I ran into this guy who works at the NFL and he thinks I should go interview there. And he's like, what did you say? I was like, I told him it's probably not a good fit. He's like, he more or less told me I was an idiot. Didn't use those words, nor would he, but he said you should take the interview. So I went through, I think, three different rounds, 14 total interviews, and ended up getting an offer to go run the sponsorship strategy group within the NFL on new business development.
Why would, I know your dad comes from the sports background, but what was he seeing? Because in my mind, you're with Cisco, you're consulting. Cisco is a massive name. You're doing well. You've got great work-life balance. You know, I assume you have, at this point, you have more than just one kid. And
we only had one. I think we were, you know, this not much time had passed since the company selling to this point. You know, we're talking 3 months, but we were expecting our second.
Got it. So there was probably then, since it was only 3 months from a time perspective, he was still seeing things as a little unstable, even though they were stable.
Totally. Well, part of being an entrepreneur to some degree is like you have to be an eternal optimist.
Yeah.
And so when I got back on that horse, I was like, I was feeling pretty good about things.
Yeah.
But he and my wife were like, wait a minute, you can have paid for healthcare and a 401k. So I think that was, you know, okay. And I had other job opportunities that had popped up, but this was the first one that was probably the most compelling, but it required a move. You know, we picked our family up and we moved back to the East Coast where I had grown up. And I think there's a part of him that wanted the grandkids a little bit closer too. So if he's being honest.
Awesome. Awesome. So you take the job with the NFL and head of sponsorships. How does that prepare you and lead us to Rome?
So I go to the NFL and it's a completely different work environment, mind you. At a startup, I am shorts and sandals, flip-flops every day. Now the NFL is still suit and tie. Suit and tie day. And you're surrounded by AstroTurf and you've got games being played on TVs and there's football pictures. The offices have plays like painted on them.
Yeah.
It's a really, really cool environment. At first I'm thinking, this is amazing. You know, I didn't think I would work in sports, but I'm so lucky. All of my friends are like, this is the coolest job you could ever have.
Yeah.
And then I really struggled with the fact that I was kind of miserable. I loved the people that I worked with, but I hated what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I think part of it was that, again, going back to that roller coaster example, it's like being on a roller coaster and then being told, you know what? From now on out, you're going to be playing it safe and you're going to be riding these kiddie rides. And you're like, but wait a minute, I've only experienced roller coasters in my career. Yeah. And coolest kiddie ride ever, this is the NFL, but it didn't have enough of that variability in the risk profile. I was, I guess I was an adrenaline junkie to a degree.
You know, it's funny that you refer to it that way because after my second failed startup, that one destroyed everything that we had. I had worked for Disney for 5 years. I call it was just a season of licking my wounds. Like I just had to go through this healing process, had to recover the family a bit, you know, restore some things, some trust that I might have lost in our relationship with my wife. And just, it was a season of that. But it's in your makeup to want, to your point, the variability, the risk, the ups and downs and the challenges that come from being an entrepreneur and doing your own thing.
Yeah. And being an entrepreneur is somewhat glamorized now. I mean, we're on a podcast talking about how did you become an entrepreneur? And people ask all the time, like, what steps should I take? I'm like, well, maybe you should first run away as far from this as you possibly can, because in many ways, it's as much a curse as it is anything else.
Yeah.
And my wife likes to joke about this. She's like, we can't go on a vacation without you wondering what the fixed cost versus variable cost of the hotel and the, you know, it's like, I wish I could turn it off to a degree and just enjoy going and having a 40-year career somewhere that I was very happy to work, you know, 9 to 5 and have the 401k and the stability in the family. That would be a lot easier in some ways for me and for my family.
Yeah. I mean, 100% it'd be easier. So you find yourself loving the people you're working with at the NFL, loving that you're working with the NFL brand, but you're not loving what you're doing. And you can see yourself missing all that you were experiencing as a founder of your own company. How do things start developing to where it's time for you to go back on your own again?
So I had this great benefit, which was that I had a very long commute. So I was commuting about an hour and a half every day each way by train. I used to call it the great equalizer. I could sleep, I could work, but most of the time I ended up reading or thinking. And I always carried a journal with me. And I remember trying to kind of self-assess. And what I realized at the time was that, why are you not enjoying this more? And what I realized is, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to build something. And I'm not okay with the fact that my first foray into this didn't succeed. I couldn't see any of the positives from it, but I had people tell me all the time, you should be incredibly proud of what you accomplished. You raised capital, you built a team, you ended up selling the assets. But in my mind, I had just failed.
Yeah.
And so the idea that I could have that opportunity again and not fail, nothing excited me more. And I remember writing down in the journal, I want to go build a brand that matters. When I said that to myself, it was like I knew that's what I was going to do. But I had just one big problem, which is I had no idea what category I was going to go into. I had a million ideas, but I didn't know which business I was going to pursue. But just knowing that's what I wanted to do heightened me to any and all opportunities that would support that long-term endeavor.
It's interesting, too, the way you phrased it, too, like that note in your journal, I want to build a brand that matters. It's not, I want to build a business. I want to develop this. I want to sell this. I want to build a brand that matters. If you can remember back to that moment, what was happening in your life where brand and contribution or significance mattered to you, that that's what was in your journal?
Well, a couple of things. One, being in the NFL and working on the sponsorship side, you get exposed to the greatest brands in the world, the brands that we all know. I was always analyzing who were leaders in the categories, who were we were going to go after to fill a specific category. One of my biggest initiatives was working on the technology category, which at the time was owned by IBM. But what I was trying to tell the NFL is, this is not a single category. This is five categories at a minimum. I mean, it's really more than that. It's a very pervasive category. But I was just so fascinated with the idea of a brand and the impact of brands. And you were starting to see the rise and emergence of brands that stood for something. And to me, that connected deeply with who I am as a person, and the idea that doing good could also be a good business model. And I had also been having a lot of conversations with just other entrepreneurs that I had stayed close to. So it was very much top of mind. And, you know, I still have that note because it was important to me.
That's awesome. So how do you go from journal to conversation with wife to actually leaving the NFL?
Conversation with wife might be another podcast on its own.
But it's an important part of the story, right? Like we often, I say all the time, like if you are married, you are never a solopreneur.
No, like you're not making that decision by yourself.
100%.
For sure. So again, I was kind of heightened to this sense of, I want to be aware of something else. That holiday season that came up, which was kind of 3 months later, I was with my very large family at our get together. And my mom, every year, her tradition is giving everybody in the family pajamas. And this has ranged from like the great one-piecers to a pair of sweatpants. And this year, she gave everybody a pair of sweatpants from a very prominent women's yoga brand.
Got it.
And I opened it up and I was like, great. Thanks, mom. Appreciate it. And my brother-in-law, who's much more into fashion than I am, was like, I'm not wearing these. And I was like, wait a minute, why? He's like, this is a women's yoga brand. I was like, well, clearly these are men's pants. He's like, yeah, but look at the logo, look at the packaging.
Okay.
I was like, oh, okay, fair point. Well, I go to work at the NFL probably like a month later that this happened, and Budweiser sent a box of this same brand for the women in the office, and they're opening it up, they're going through it. And I was like, oh, I have some of their sweatpants. And I distinctly remember still to this day, one of my closest friends, but he sat next to me, he said, oh, do you buy your underwear at Victoria's Secret? And it admittedly, I did not grow up with any sense of fashion or a perspective in terms of, you know, how brands or fashion really work together. But I was like, this is clearly a thing. People clearly are saying this is an impressive brand, but it's designated to be a women's brand. And so I started doing some analysis and talking to my brother-in-law who had initially brought this up. And what we found is that you had most of the, in the activewear category, men were being serviced by these brands that we had grown up with, the brands that were predominantly wholesale. More than 80% of their business was through wholesale. They sold probably 55 to 60% of their product to men. And, you know, the rest were to women. And then you had this huge emergence of female-focused premium brands, brands that were at a 40 to 60% price premium to these men's brands, but less than 15% of their sales were to men. And on the men's side, there was no one.
Nobody
who sold more than 80-plus percent of their product to men in active at a 40 to 60% price premium to these big market brands that we had grown up with. And that was kind of the aha moment for us.
And I love that you're not a fashion person and you got to there. I love that component.
Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, being an entrepreneur is you see opportunities where, you know, where others don't sometimes. And it goes back to that idea of being an eternal optimist. If I had worked in this industry, I would have been the first one to tell me all the reasons why this wouldn't work. You know, how hard it is to actually make product, how hard it is to build a global supply chain, how hard it is to source and nominate fabrics and get to margin and satisfy customers and reach stores. But my ignorance was probably my best aid in saying, oh yeah, we could do that. Yeah, we could, we could definitely do that. And that's what creates the momentum and gets you started to the point where, you know, you're willing to take a leap. And I think it's one of the reasons why disruption so often comes outside of industries versus within them.
Oh my goodness, that's incredible. So as this idea is percolating, as you're now seeing the analysis, you're seeing the market, you're seeing the opportunity, where is your wife with this?
I will say this about my wife. She is the most supportive person you've ever met. She was kind of indulging this thing that I was doing on the side because she was seeing energy and excitement from it, which I didn't necessarily have with my everyday job. It was kind of like, if this makes you happy, you know, I want you to be careful because, you know, I'm really enjoying this stability that we've now created.
Yep.
But if this makes you happy, I'm supportive. But there's another wrinkle to the story that I haven't yet discussed, which is that I have a chronic health condition. I'm type 1 diabetic. And being type 1 diabetic, you're managing your blood sugar levels every single day. There's highs, there's lows. Everything you eat needs to be quantified. You need to think through how exercise impacts your levels. To a very real extent, you face your own mortality on a daily basis. If you give yourself too much insulin or not enough insulin, you face hospitalization or even death. And so that was on her mind more than it was on my mind, but I was really burning the candle at both ends in trying to get this business off the ground. I was not ready to leave a full-time job and fully commit to it for the stability reasons, but I knew that it required a huge amount of work to get it off the ground. And about a week before our launch, I was staying up late working on the site with these outsourced developers that we had hired. And I went to bed having given myself some insulin for food that I was going to eat, but then forgot to eat because I was so tired. I was like 2 weeks of basically staying up till 1 to 2 in the morning, then getting up at 6 and getting on a train. And I fell asleep and I had diabetic seizures. My blood sugar dropped so low that I woke up in the hospital.
Oh man.
That was kind of the real wake up call. You know, that was when my wife looked at me and said, something's got to give. You either need to stop this nonsense of this like little startup that you have on the side, or you need to kind of go after it. And the truth is like, that was really scary for me. At the time, we had two kids, and I just started thinking through all of the different factors and and risks. And so I walked away from what is now Roan for a period of time. And
how long?
You know, essentially put it on the shelf for 3 or 4 months. And my brother-in-law, who was my co-founder and helping on this, 4 days after my hospitalization, his kitchen and house nearly burned down from a oven fire. Their oven had been recalled, but they hadn't noticed it. And so it sparked in the back, caught on fire. And we were looking at each other. We were like, we are crazy. We're like, we both have good jobs. We both have families. We need to stop this.
Yeah.
But we ended up coming back to it and then kind of jumping in with both feet and ended up launching the brand.
4 months is not a lot of time to forget those, you know, the seizures, the house fire, whatever the case may be. So there has to be a very compelling draw to want to leave the stability and continue to go back on the venture you were working on.
Yeah, there is. It's clinically nuts. It's the only nothing else seems to make sense.
So now let's jump into the Roan story. I feel like we can go for so much longer, but our time, unfortunately, is coming to an end. That's the case for so many of these incredible episodes with great founders as yourself. So as you are launching Roan, there's so much that comes into the launching of any company, let alone an apparel company, a brand that you want to do something that has not been done before in the men's space specifically. And you had so much learnings from your previous startup. So in the launching and starting of Roan, what lessons did you have from your previous venture, whether it be the way you raise capital, operations, whatever the case may be, client acquisition? What lessons did you learn from that tech startup that applied to how you started and grew Roan?
Well, there's a lot. But in the interest of time, I would say, you know, it really boiled down to one thing, and that was spending time on things that really delivered value and credibility to the business and not spending time on things that didn't do that. You know, in my first startup, you know, I was really focused on what the logo would look like, what the name was, what, you know, what my business card said. In the next business, it was, can we make great product? And that's pretty much it. That was the focus. Yeah. Then it was, how could we grow? What are the channels of distribution? What are the connections that mattered? Every hour, every minute spent was focused on delivering and driving value. Whereas in the first experience, it was almost like playing entrepreneur versus really creating value.
How did you fund it from the beginning?
Well, in the beginning, it didn't require a tremendous amount of capital, a little bit that me and my co-founder put in for product development. But we decided we were going to need to raise some capital to do our first inventory run. So we basically went to friends, and the pitch was, we know almost nothing about fashion, e-commerce, and retail. So if you're going to invest, don't put more money in than your significant other or partner would be upset if you lost, because you're probably going to lose it.
I love it.
We raised about $150,000 initially through almost all $10,000, a couple of $5,000 checks.
That's incredible. I love that's such a solid pitch too.
Yeah, it was very honest. I mean, it was very brutally honest.
So two people that, to your point, don't come from fashion, don't have retail experience. What was your process to understand designs, to understand what consumers wanted, to understand fit, right? I mean, just all the things that come from apparel that you are doing so well now with the Roan brand, but that wasn't the case at day one. How did you fumble your way through it? And I apologize if it wasn't a fumble, but in my mind, I had to think there was all kinds of fumbles that took place. How did you get through that?
Yeah, I look back at our first run of stuff, and I think it still was better in many ways than what was out there. But I want to hug all of our customers that bought that first round of product, because you know, when I compare and contrast that to where we are today, you know, we've obviously come a long way that way. But we partnered with experts in the space, and we had no full-time employees really for the first 3 or 4 months of the business. We are in a very different place than I think a lot of the digitally native brands that launch today, with almost like this clear playbook. It's build a hero product, raise a bunch of money beforehand, hire a branding agency to do all your logo work and creative. We were so scrappy in those early days. I hear about teams launching their first product. They've got 20 plus employees. And I'm like, I was part-time on this.
Yeah.
But it was really about finding experts in the space and asking a lot of questions. I'm a very curious person by nature. I ask a lot of questions. And usually when I get the first answer, you know, it sounds like you're very much the same way. It's what makes you a yep. great host. Tell me more about that. And how does that work? And
yeah.
And so you start to challenge a lot of things that you don't even realize you're challenging. They're just trying to understand them as a consumer. Why on earth wouldn't there be a pocket specifically meant to hold your phone? I mean, we were, at least to my knowledge, we were the first men's shorts to put a pocket meant specifically for your device in there. Now it's like everywhere, but at the time we had not seen it before. It was just a question. And, you know, our socks have this silicone pad in the back to prevent slipping down. And that just came from the annoyance of having socks slip into your shoes. And it was like, why wouldn't you put something to prevent it from slipping in? And it's like, oh, well, because nobody's ever brought that to us before. And we're like, well, can you just do it?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, it's going to cost more. And we're like, yeah, that's okay. So it's just a lot of asking questions and working with smart people.
What was your launch strategy? I mean, right now, first off, what year did Roan launch?
2014 officially.
So 2014, Instagram was around. Now Instagram is like a place a lot of products get a lot yep. of awareness. I don't know if that was part of your strategy in 2014
no.
at the time. How did Roan come out the gate? I mean, a lot of people now thinking right now, well, James, that's easy. We leverage Kickstarters. We leverage Amazon Store. We leverage Instagram. Like, what was your go-to-market strategy with Roan?
I would say we fumbled through it, you know, as I kind of outlined. We basically had developed five core products that we felt were necessary to go and build a brand. And then we leveraged digital channels of distribution all through Roan.com. So the initial idea was that we would be 100% direct to consumer. We had spoken with the founders of Bonobos and Warby Parker and tried to understand what was happening in the landscape. And the truth is that, and you see a lot of these digitally native brands that are starting right around that time, because every single category for the first time in a long time was up for grabs with a super low cost of entry. There were still arbitrage opportunities in terms of digital spending, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. And it was really just, let's go into a category where there's not another digitally native brand already, and let's go and try and own this category. We happened to pick an incredibly complex one, but we had these five products and our main method of sales was email. In preparing for our launch, me and we ended up bringing in a third co-founder, had these pass-along cards, and we used to hold competitions to see who could give out the most of these to basically get people to go to the website. And when people went to the website, the only thing they could do was enter their email address. So when we launched, I think we had accumulated somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 emails just through friends, family, networking, et cetera.
Oh, wow.
And that led to us doing sales immediately. But we weren't spending a dime on advertising the first year. We didn't even know how to.
If you were to launch Roan today, knowing what you know, how would you do it?
I would definitely align on the product that I think presented the biggest market opportunity.
And this is 5 years ago, mind you. Like, for listeners, when I say, how would you do it now? What have you learned? It's 5 years. Like, that's all we're talking about.
Yeah, five and a half almost
years,
six.
Yeah.
But yes, it was, I would have centered around a hero product. I would have pushed that hero product really, really hard. I would have had a team on the performance marketing side that was ready to kind of push ad sales and spending. I would have invested more in the upfront site infrastructure. It was basically me doing the Shopify template and this outsourced developer in Pakistan that I had hired for $15 an hour. And then our social media strategy, which was super sophisticated, was my co-founder tweeting about us before we had even registered our handles. And I was at the zoo at the time with my kids, and I'm panicked and I start going and registering our handles. So when I look back at what we went through, it's a miracle we survived, because we really didn't know what we were doing. We just figured it out along the way.
But you always wanted to be direct to consumer. You never thought, I want to go to big box. It was always, we are the brand. I want to own the consumer experience.
Well, that part was clear. And the reason why it was clear is because we were seeing what was happening in the space. I mean, when I say we didn't know what we were doing, we were students of the industry, and we read a lot. It just, again, became clear that you had these huge incumbent brands that were so heavily relying on a channel, which was predominantly through retail, And as online transactions picked up and scaled, you knew these companies weren't going to get sophisticated fast enough that they were going to get caught in a trap. Consumers were going to shift dollars away from retail spending, and that would present an opportunity for new brands to come in and disrupt. That part we understood. That was the main philosophy. But we did quickly pivot into allowing for a wholesale opportunity because of some research that we read that basically found that men make their clothing decisions based on, one, what they already own, and two, what they see in store displays. Whether or not that's still accurate at the time, that's what the data showed. Hmm. So we just decided, however we can get into a man's closet, the better. And if, you know, our main competitor isn't going to show up in an Equinox or a Nordstrom, let's go there. Let's go show up there, get into a guy's closet, and then when they want to add more product, they can come to us. And that's led us to becoming the number one men's brand for Equinox, the number one men's brand for Peloton, one of the fastest growing men's brands within Nordstrom.
As you push to continue to build Roan to be, per your journal, a brand that matters, what does the growth of Roan look like? And we, if we were to have this Where Are They Now episode in 5 years, what does Roan look like?
Well, numerically, we have some big aspirational goals in terms of what we're trying to achieve. You know, we believe that Roan can be a $1 billion brand, can have a significant impact in terms of the way men live, work, and think from a content perspective. But more than anything, I want to make sure that from a internal culture perspective, that we remain an incredible place to work, a place that supports individual pursuits and passions, and that we continue to stay committed and rooted in the principles that we built this brand on. That remains fundamental to everything that we do.
What's your vision for the female capsule, the women's capsule that just launched recently?
That was a fun thing to do. That was really a give back to our internal female team. We have more female employees than we do male employees. We wanted to do something to honor and pay homage to them around International Women's Day. Now, the capsule sold incredibly well. We, you know, within 48 hours started breaking on sizes for products. So it certainly will make us look at that category more closely. But for now, there's no immediate plans on the horizon of doing more women's.
Awesome. Well, there's so many more things that I would love to ask, but I'm always big on honoring our founders' time. And so there are three questions, though, that I never walk away from without asking because they're just so critical. The first one is one that my wife actually asked me in episode 50 when I unpacked my story and I had her interview me because she is so pivotal in my story. And she asked me if I thought, are entrepreneurs made or are they born that way? And I want to ask you the same question. Do you believe that an entrepreneur is born to be an entrepreneur or it's something that they learn?
I think it's both. You know, I think to a degree, the risk-taking nature of individuals and the desire to kind of have that risk is somewhat innate. And I think, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. But there are entrepreneurs of all kinds, shapes, and sizes. And so it's impossible to kind of package everybody neatly into this box. So in many ways, I think that I'm a very different entrepreneur today than I was when I started back in my first startup. Yeah. And so, you know, I would say good entrepreneurs are made. Certainly there are people who are more prone to taking risks and starting businesses, but I think it's probably the latter of those two.
That's awesome. So when you look back on your entire journey and all the people that have helped contribute to where you are today, this last question is about gratitude. And I ask this question because I believe that if we forget all the people that helped us to get to where we are, if we forget all the shoulders that we stood upon to see how we can see things now, we begin to isolate ourselves, and that isolation will ultimately lead to our failure because we start thinking we could do it ourselves. I'm a big believer in community. And so when you look back on your journey, who are the people that you point to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to your journey?
That is a very long list. But, you know, at the very top of it would be my wife as well. Just an incredible pillar of support who has believed in me in times when I didn't believe in myself. And then my family members in general who have been there for me. I have the blessing of coming from a very large extended family too. I have over 60 first cousins. So,
oh my goodness.
Imagine launching a consumer business where you have a built-in audience to say, come and buy and share. So And I'd have to mention the team at Roan. I just have an amazing team that believes in and supports me, and supports me knowing how imperfect and flawed I am as a leader. And still with that, they still support me. So I've got a long list of people I'm grateful for.
That's awesome. I love it. Absolutely love it. For the length of this episode, we've been talking to the tens of thousands of people. And I consider the Startup Story to be a digital mentor for everyone that chooses to subscribe and to listen. And one of the gifts that I like to give to my audience is a chance to have that one-on-one with a founder. So while we've been talking to the masses, I would like to bring the conversation down to just you and a single founder. And whether that founder is someone who has started a business and is just frustrated with the lack of traction they're getting, or they're comparing their journey with another startup's journey and they're not where they are, and therefore they're finding themselves in a place of discouragement. Or maybe they're an entrepreneur who has tried time and time again and just continues to get punched in the face and just can't keep going on. They're about to call it quits. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur that I call the wantrepreneur, the one who's got a 9-to-5 and a book full of ideas and is riding that hour and a half subway, just journaling, but has some narrative as to why they can't move forward on that dream or that business that they have or that brand they want to build that matters. Whoever that persona is, whatever one resonates with you specifically because of your personal story, I'd like you to speak to that one person. And what do you have to say to that person?
I want to speak to you, the defeated entrepreneur, to let you know that I have been there and that success is not a straight line. It is absolutely filled with starts and stops and zigs and zags. And if you look at most anybody who has accomplished anything, it has been fraught, their line has been fraught with failures. And the most important thing that you can do is to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep moving forward. Take steps forward every single day. Failures happen for a variety of reasons. They happen for timing. They can happen for bad partners. They can happen because you've made mistakes. But the only thing that matters is that you decide to get back up, take accountability, and start taking action to move yourself forward.
Once you've had a few minutes to process all the value Nate brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. Lastly, if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. Roan is a startup that is making a tremendous amount of noise in the activewear space. One easy way for you to support Roan would be to visit roan.com. That's R-H-O-N-E.com. And purchase something there for yourself or the man in your life. Another way to support Roan would be to connect with Nate directly on LinkedIn. And we will include a link to both of those, to roan.com and to Nate's LinkedIn profile. We'll include both those links in our show notes. Remember, entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So let's show up for Nate Checkitz and Roan in a huge way. And now for my personal ask.
The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at StartupStory_. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to this show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story.
If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osment. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.